just 18 months after the entire population of Pitcairn Island resettled on Norfolk Island, some 3,700 miles or 6,000 kilometers away, a small group decided to leave and rejoin their island of birth. In 1864, 27 more islanders decided to return to Pitcairn, unhappy with the interference of the British government on a territory promised to them. However, this generation of settlers were immediately at a disadvantage upon their homecoming. Many of the island's resources had been destroyed by the shipwrecked sailors while the islanders had been away, and other belongings and resources had been taken to Norfolk in the move. Not to mention, this group of islanders had been, essentially, dropped off by other boats and had no ships or sails of their own to pull resources from, unlike the original mutineers of the Bounty. After repairing their weathered and vandalized homes, there were no resources and, honestly, no energy left to continue developing the island, and the rest of it was reclaimed by nature. To make matters much worse, visits from passing ships were becoming increasingly rare. Due to the fickle nature of the whaling industry, the amount of fishermen and whaling crews from abroad visiting the South Pacific began to drop. The island originally saw about 40 ships visit a year, decades before the move to Norfolk, but now, about 20 years later, they were lucky to get more than 10 ships to stop a year. Meanwhile, over at Norfolk Island, the former Pitcairn people went on with their lives for a time, going on to try to cultivate the land and work with technology they didn't have on Pitcairn. Allegedly, they were very amused by anything that had wheels. Though, instead of properly utilizing the tools that the prisoners had left behind, they went on to allow carts to roll off the hills and smash into the rocks below. Over time, they developed a real hit-or-miss relationship with exporting crops. Whaling was still popular enough that it kept Norfolk afloat, even though it wasn't enough to drive fishermen to Pitcairn's area. It became a lucrative industry for the Norfolk folk. A few families visited Pitcairn Island from Norfolk and begged their Pitcairn brethren to return with them to the relative prosperity of Norfolk, but these Pitcairn people didn't budge. On the flip side of this, though, the boats that did arrive to Pitcairn tended to have travelers aboard touring the area. The Pitcairn people saw this as an advantage and adapted to the needs and demands of the new visitors. Instead of a haven to whalers looking to restock, Pitcairn decided to become a hotspot for tourists who were quite interested in being able to pick up various knickknacks and keepsakes from the islanders. This happened to coincide with a series of shipwrecks in the area. The Pitcairn islanders would use the wreckage of boats they found following these storms to gather more resources, and they would also tend to any survivors who washed up. In return, any sailors who made it back to their crew or homes would remember the kindness of the people of Pitcairn and often send more goods and even tourists their way. After a period of strife, things started to slowly look up for Pitcairn Island. Welcome back to Extremities. This is episode 4 of 6 about Pitcairn. If you haven't listened to the earlier episodes, you should go back and do that now, as they give crucial context to today's. We'll get back to Pitcairn, but first, I need to thank one of the sponsors that made this show possible. As you've probably heard in the past, I've long bought all my domains through Hover. That's because they have transparent and reasonable pricing and a buying process which takes, quite literally, about 2 minutes. They also have over 400 domain extensions that allow you to really get creative with your domain and get something memorable. For example, I bought the domain wendover.productions for the website of my YouTube channel. I then took about another 30 seconds to set up an email through Hover ending in @wendover.productions so I can be sure to look professional whenever I email. If you ever need help, they also have best-in-class customer service. If you need a domain, you should get it today before it's gone, and you can do that for 10% off by heading to hover.com/ext. Once again, that's hover.com/ext for 10% off your first domain. When you hear about something that exists on Pitcairn, if you're wondering who's funding it, the answer, more likely than not, is Britain. The UK government sent the island about $4 million in aid yearly. If you break that down, that's about $80,000 that the UK government spends for each Pitcairner each year. That goes to pay for things like the school, hospital, roads, the Bravo supporter, the post office, the general store, the phones, really everything is subsidized on Pitcairn. That's especially the case since Pitcairners pay absolutely no income taxes. There's also significant aid from the EU, more than $2 million in the past 5 years, although it's believed that this EU aid might go away with Brexit. It's obviously expensive to have a settlement so far away from every other, but to the average Pitcairner, living expenses are apparently under $10,000 a year. Now, I'm sure any UK taxpayer is wondering why their government is spending so much money on an island so small and so far away. Well, it's because they have to. There are some rather complex United Nations international laws requiring countries with overseas territories like those of the UK to support those territories if they fail to reach a level of self-sufficiency. Of course, the existence of Pitcairn does get the UK something. They get an enormous exclusive economic zone. This is the zone of ocean within which countries have exclusive rights to use the ocean for economic purposes such as fishing, drilling, and more. The zone is 230 miles or 370 kilometers from the coast of any bit of a country's territory, meaning that, with the radii around Pitcairn and its neighboring islands, that translates to quite a lot of territory. That means that the UK is the only country that can perform commercial fishing in Pitcairn's waters, for example. That is, it would be like that if they hadn't declared the entirety of Pitcairn's exclusive economic zone a marine reserve in 2016. This is obviously great for Pitcairn and its surroundings' marine environment. It's preserving what is already one of the most preserved areas of the world, but it does mean that, economically, Pitcairn basically does absolutely nothing for the UK. Of course, $80,000 a person in spending is quite a lot, but $4 million a year total for the UK to spend to keep this bit of territory inhabited is truly nothing. It's a rounding error in their budget, and beyond their legal obligation to, it's probably worth it to them to assert their sovereignty in this far-flung region of the world. That's why the UK pours so much money into Pitcairn year in and year out. Now, one of the many British-funded resources on Pitcairn is the school. It's called the Poolau School, and it's just outside downtown Adamstown. Both in size and design, it could easily be mistaken for a house. Inside, though, there's one main room, an adjacent library, a small computer room, and an even smaller kitchen. Students aren't really divided by age at Poolau School. It's been quite a while since its enrollment has been any more than single digits, and there's only one teacher, so all the pupils learn together. Like many things on Pitcairn, the school aligns itself closer to New Zealand than Britain. They follow the Kiwi curriculum, with good practical reason. Once a Pitcairner turns 13, with very little exception, they go and continue their education in New Zealand. Students will attend a New Zealand boarding school, usually subsidized by the government. While many Pitcairners have New Zealand citizenship, those that don't can get a visa for work and study quite easily. There are specific Pitcairn Islander visas in New Zealand that basically give any of them indefinite residency with only a few conditions. This education system has consequences.
And so their population, they have nobody that's between the ages of 14 to say over 30. There's nobody between those ages. Most of the people, you know, there's the four kids and then everybody else is probably in their 40s or older there.
That's, of course, Dustin Funheller, who you heard from last episode. What he's talking about is, the years of high school, 13 to 18, are quite formative years, and by the time a Pitcairner ends school, they will have become accustomed to the New Zealand big city way of life. Given the choice between Adamstown and Auckland, most all choose Auckland. The first consequence of this is, of course, the rather old and aging population of Pitcairn, which we'll talk plenty more about later, but the second is that pretty much every Pitcairner will have spent part of their life living in New Zealand. This is part of the reason why the Pitcairn identity is so much closer linked to New Zealand than Britain, and it also probably has a lot of influence on their accents. From what I've heard, it seems the younger a Pitcairner is, the closer their accent is to a Kiwi one. It's a bit hard to pinpoint, but the older Pitcairners seem to have an accent perhaps halfway to those of Maori people, the indigenous Polynesian people of New Zealand. This, of course, makes sense given the mix of British, Polynesian, and Kiwi influences on the Pitcairn people through history. There is also a Pitcairn language. It's a Creole language, a mix between the 18th century English of the mutineers and the Tahitian language of other settlers. This is spoken to varying degrees on both Pitcairn and Norfolk, and some common phrases include, and I promise you I'm not pronouncing this right, Wadawaye, which means how are you, Yalaika some weddles, meaning would you like some food, and Isegwenanawe, which means I'm going swimming. Like many small languages, the Pitcairn language is too losing influence as Pitcairn becomes a little more globalized with more chips, more moving back and forth, and more access to the internet, TV, and phones. Those internet and phones and TV first arrived in Pitcairn houses in 2006. There had previously been a more rudimentary communication system, but this was the first time people would have their own phones, own TV, and own internet connections rather than just shared public ones. Surprisingly, this first connection to the outside world came not thanks to the UK government, but rather the US's. You see, the United States Geological Survey was setting up a seismic monitoring station on Pitcairn. The island is, after all, not too far from the famed Ring of Fire where many earthquakes occur. For this monitoring station, though, they needed an internet connection to transmit data, so a small team from a satellite communications company called Stratos, now part of Inmarsat, took about a month that year to install a satellite connection. Locals could essentially pay to use the extra bandwidth from this connection. They got a speed of 256 kilobits per second and would pay about $35 per gigabyte. With this connection, though, they also got reliable phones and TVs in each house. The two TV channels they apparently received were one from Tahiti, which was in French, and Fox News. To anyone not used to it, the internet was unbearably slow and was frequently hit or miss. In 2016, the entire island's communications even went down for months. They discovered that the communications equipment, which was housed in a shed by the satellite dishes, had corroded, and it was too complex an issue for anyone on the island to fix. Therefore, they had to wait for someone to come out on the next supply ship to fix it. Now, in the year of 2016, months without any internet or phones was too much to handle even for the isolated Pitcairners. The island's administrative headquarters in New Zealand passed the word onto the families of the islanders that they were alright, just without communications, and then the government made a portable satellite phone available to the islanders from 10:30 to 11:30 each morning. They allowed each family 6 minutes of calls a week, and they could also send short emails, as long as they didn't include any attachments, through the phone. The internet was eventually fixed though, and then in early 2018, they received an upgrade.
2 years ago when I came, it was very slow and very expensive, but since then they've had an upgrade, which I'm quite surprised about. I've been able to quite comfortably use Facebook and emails and things like that, and it's quite a bit cheaper. You're not as scared to use the internet here.
That upgrade essentially brought the cost down and quality up to a point where islanders could browse the internet fairly regularly. Brad even has a YouTube channel where he has documented his trips, eponymously named Brad Brown, that he was able to upload to while on Pitcairn. He did say that it took many, many hours for videos to upload, but they still did upload. Also, every bit of audio you've heard of Brad was recorded from a phone call we had while he was on the island. Over the 90 or so minutes we talked, the call didn't drop out once, and I was able to hear him quite clearly. That's despite the fact that there is no physical cable connecting Pitcairn to the outside world. Every communication comes in and goes out by satellite. With the current connection, they're even able to have semi-regular video chats with Pitcairn's current governor, Laura Clark. Despite all these recent improvements though, costs are still quite high compared to the rest of the world, and telecommunications represent about an eighth of the average Pitcairner's living expenses. All this modernity though requires one important thing. Electricity. Electricity costs the average Pitcairner over $2,000 a year, and even this is subsidized.
They have a big generator on the island that provides all the electricity. I believe it was diesel was what they used, and they've actually never ran out of fuel for the generator.
All the fuel comes in on the Bravo supporter, which of course makes it expensive, but they're able to predict demand fairly well and bring in the appropriate amount on each shipment.
I believe from 10:30 to like 7:30 or 6:30, I think it may be 10:30 to 6:30, they have no electricity. They turn off electricity on the entire island. So that's just something that the residents have to be aware of.
By turning the power off in the middle of the night, they save money. The island uses up to 16,000 gallons or 60,000 liters of diesel per year, which, buying in Auckland, costs about $65,000 per year, plus the enormous cost of bringing it out on the Bravo supporter. There have been some failed schemes and plans to bring solar or wind power to Pitcairn, as these would likely give 24/7 electricity, as systems can include battery power banks, while also emitting far fewer pollutants. Building such a system, though, would come at enormous cost and is therefore at the whim of Pitcairn's sources of aid funding. But let's shift gears away from how the islanders spend their money to how they make their money. For much of the 20th century, Pitcairn experienced a sort of economic boom time, in a way. You see, this century was really the heyday of stamp collecting. As Pitcairn was one of the most unique places one could get a stamp from, the sale of Pitcairn stamps was a huge business. Whenever Pitcairn released a new issue of stamps, collectors worldwide would snatch them up in an instant. This industry was so significant, in fact, that Pitcairn actually didn't rely on government aid at all in the 20th century. In the 90s, though, stamp collecting fell out of fashion, and this hit the island hard. Pitcairn had a reserve fund, but this ran out in 2002, which was when they started receiving aid from the UK Department for International Development. This agency, as the Pitcairn stamp industry spiraled downwards, funded a project in 1988 to start up a new industry, the honey industry. Now, there was already a small honey industry on the island keeping bees that had been brought out in 1978 and 1992, but what this project included was training for Pitcairn's beekeepers and an analysis of the disease level of the bees. It's apparently fairly inevitable that any bees will have some diseases, but not Pitcairn's. As their bees have essentially been quarantined for decades, the test proved that they were nearly completely disease-free, and so they apparently produce some of the purest honey in the world. This honey has gained a fan base, which apparently includes Queen Elizabeth II. It's been sold in high-end stores all around the world, including Fortuna and Mason in London. Each time the Bravo supporter makes its run to Auckland, it's filled with hundreds of bottles of Pitcairn honey destined for all those who have paid their $10 to try it out. This industry has not even come close to the former size of that of stamps, but it is a solid source of income for many islanders. One other source of revenue for Pitcairn is the sale of domain names. In the same way that Germany has .de domains, the UK has .uk domains, Qatar has .qa domains, and Nepal has .np domains, Pitcairn has .pn domains. You see, each country or dependent territory worldwide is allocated one of these top-level domains by the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, and Pitcairn got .pn. Plenty of small countries have actually gotten quite lucky with their domain allocation. For example, the Federated States of Micronesia got .fm, while Tuvalu got .tv. Each therefore makes big business of selling domain names using their country's top-level domain to radio stations, podcasts, streaming sites, TV sites, and whoever else wants their domain to end in .fm or .tv. The tiny 11,000-person Pacific Island nation of Tuvalu has made many tens of millions of dollars off of .tv. The first money they made off this was even used to pay their fees to enter the United Nations. Pitcairn wasn't nearly as lucky, of course, as .pn has far fewer applications. That doesn't mean it has no applications, though. ESPN, for example, owns the domain es.pn as a short URL, while Groupon has gr.pn. In 2012, as the first Hunger Games movie was being released, the .pn domain name was also used for a viral marketing campaign by Lionsgate. The movie takes place in the fictional nation of Panem, which, if real, might have the top-level domain of .pn. Therefore, they created a fake website for the government of Panem at thecapital.pn. Registering a domain ending in .pm costs $100 a year, but it has to be done directly on the Pitcairn government website. You can't buy .pn domains on website builders or domain registration websites, which no doubt limits how common these domains are. Nonetheless, though, it provides some more income for Pitcairn with very little effort. Now, one last important thing to know about the Pitcairn economy is that basically nobody works just one job. One day someone might be tending to their honeybees, the next they might be working at the general store, then the next they might be heading out to a cruise ship to give talks about life on Pitcairn. When the Bravo supporter is there, though, especially right after it's arrived from its quarterly Auckland run, basically every able-bodied person will be busy unloading it. It's a lot of work and has become even more work since they switched to the Bravo supporter earlier in 2019.
This new cargo ship has four times the amount of cargo on board and a fresh crew as well. So everyone's sort of learning how to load the cargo into the longboats because it is a tricky process, not fast, and it can be a little daunting sometimes having a rocking boat. Right now it is taking quite a while to get everything off.
Brad, as a visiting Pitcairner in his 20s, has gotten an up-close and personal understanding of how the unloading process works.
The containers are specially made for the longboats. They're 6-foot by 6-foot containers. You can fit three of them in a longboat. They pack three in, and then we'll just bring them into the landing and load them onto either a trailer or on the front forks of a tractor and drive them up the hill to where they need to be.
With the size of Pitcairn, it doesn't matter what your real job is. When there's work to do, especially if you're young and in good health, you do it because there's nobody else that can. We have much more to explain about how Pitcairn Island works, But first, I need to thank one of the sponsors that made Extremities possible. Now, Skillshare, as their name implies, is the definitive place to learn new skills. They have over 25,000 classes that help you learn things like photography, design, animation, writing, editing, and even much more trivial skills like how to solve a Rubik's Cube. One class that I would highly recommend is their Storytelling 101 class. It doesn't matter what sort of writing you're doing, whether it's a high school biology report or the next best-selling novel, storytelling is important, and this class teaches you the skills behind effective storytelling. Skillshare is offering Extremities listeners a whole 2 months of unlimited access to their more than 25,000 classes by signing up at skillshare.com/extremities. Once again, that's skillshare.com/extremities for 2 months of unlimited access. Now, there's one more part of Pitcairn that we need to explain today. Its surroundings. There are, of course, no inhabited islands immediately around Pitcairn, but there are islands. Henderson, Ducie, and Oeno. That's why the overseas territory is called the Pitcairn Islands, rather than Island. Oeno is the closest at around 90 miles or 150 kilometers away. Henderson, meanwhile, is 120 miles or 200 kilometers away, while Ducie is the furthest at over 300 miles or 500 kilometers away. Each of these other islands was incorporated into the British Empire at different times and for different reasons, but they were each ultimately placed under Pitcairn's jurisdiction and stayed there as the rest of the British possessions in the Pacific were granted independence. Now, unlike Pitcairn, each of these three other islands have either no fresh water or unreliable freshwater sources, which makes them each, at least in the short term, uninhabitable. These islands, being even more isolated than Pitcairn, can go years between seeing any humans. Brad Brown, though, has been to one of them. He's been to Henderson Island.
I was lucky enough to get on board the Bravo Supporter just a day after I arrived here and get out to Henderson Island.
Brad's visit was due to a reason more unfortunate than just tourism. Due to ocean currents, a disgusting and ecologically devastating amount of plastic debris has washed up on Henderson Island. According to 2017 research, Henderson apparently has the highest recorded density of plastic debris of anywhere worldwide.
The plastic rubbish that washes up on the beach there is amazing, or amazing, disgusting, and horrible. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. There's just plastic everywhere. And there is an expedition in June where they're taking scientists and a whole group of people, divers, and they're looking at the plastic, trying to figure out where it's coming from and how much there is and what they can do about it. And then also a cleanup crew is going to be making a start on it. So this trip was sort of to take a look at anchorages for the ship, how to get ashore, because it's very tricky. The reefs around there are very tricky.
I watched Brad's video of Henderson, and it looks like an island in the middle of the Hudson, not the middle of the Pacific. The entire beach is covered in bottles and cans and fishing line and toilet seats and buoys and tiny plastic particulate with an incredible density. Henderson barely ever sees humans, but it certainly sees their impact every single day. Oeno Island, meanwhile, is in a little better shape. It used to see visits from the islanders fairly regularly. Because, of course, Pitcairn is far too busy, Oeno's other name is Holiday Island.
Back when my father was growing up, they used to go and spend their summers there, so, you know, like weeks at a time on Oeno, that was their summer hotspot. Unfortunately, nowadays, the islanders don't get to go to any of the islands.
Oeno's just experienced a very brief and small tourism heyday, though. On the day before this podcast comes out, July 2nd, 2019, was a solar eclipse. Now, the reason you probably didn't hear about it is because it was basically only able to be seen over the Pacific Ocean and a small portion of South America. It just happens, though, that the path of totality, where the sun was completely covered, passed over Oeno Island. Therefore, for anyone willing to shell up $5,438, they offered a special 8-day trip on the Bravo Supporter starting in Mangareva, visiting Pitcairn, then heading up to Oeno to watch the 2-minute, 48-second total eclipse on this deserted island. This was just a one-off, though, as Oeno's heyday, much like Pitcairn's, is over. But let's go back to that heyday. By the 1880s, Pitcairn's population was nearly 100, and the people were thriving. Thanks to friendships with cruise ships all over the world, Pitcairn had been given generous supplies of food, cotton, flour, clothes, books, candles, soap, cookware, cement, and a church organ. Queen Victoria also sent another organ as a sign of her pleasure with the upbringing of the community as an English settlement, though it took over 2 years for her to confirm that the islanders actually got the instrument. Speaking of church, the islanders had belonged to the Church of England since the community had been built, but by 1886, reading materials concerning the Seventh-day Adventist Church made their way to the island from America and piqued the Pitcairners' interest. Soon after, a traveling missionary by the name of John Tay was allowed to stay on the island and teach the people there about the fundamental beliefs behind the Adventist Church. By 1890, John was ordained to perform baptisms for the islanders, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church sent missionaries there to oversee the conversion. The conversion was welcomed by the Pitcairn people, who naturally already followed many of the church commands and guidelines, so their lifestyle on the island made it pretty easy. To this day, the vast majority of islanders are Seventh-day Adventist. In the 1890s, these same missionaries who converted the islanders to the Seventh-day Adventist Church also took up teaching in the community school. Pitcairn enjoyed various lessons in modern grammar, recent history, and were even given cooking lessons as they now had more tools and food to work with, and the islanders were also introduced to new medicine and medical techniques over the course of the decade. This age of enlightenment also drove the islanders to reform their government. After altering their government to a 7-member parliament to oversee their judiciary system, Pitcairn Island now had official laws that punished adultery, domestic abuse, and voyeurism. Pitcairn had come a long way, and it owed a lot of its progress to James McCoy, a local who was a descendant of the bounty crew member William McCoy. McCoy had been elected to serve Pitcairn as magistrate in his mid-20s, and over the following years, McCoy would go on to be elected the chief executive of the island over 20 times. McCoy owed his leadership skills to an impressive amount of traveling he'd done across England. Before 1900, McCoy led the island into a new state of purpose and hard work, using his time abroad as an example, and he was deeply revered. In 1904, the government would get another reboot, adding committees to deal with both internal affairs and marine affairs. Taxation without representation was brought to an end, and a tax was introduced for those who owned firearms. Though Pitcairn was feeling a lot better about overhauling the parliamentary system, another problem began to arise that threatened Pitcairn's longevity. Europe's obsession with conquering the Pacific region was coming to an end, which meant even less traffic came Pitcairn's way. Thankfully, in 1914, the Panama Canal opened and bridged the gap between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and for those traveling to New Zealand via this new track, they'd find themselves at Pitcairn on the halfway point of their journey across the Pacific. Tourism saved Pitcairn again, only this time, they had to deal with a ship every week full of tourists desperate to see the island and get more knickknacks. Around this time, the neighboring islands of Ducie, Henderson, and Owino were annexed by the British. With the dawn of the 20th century, all of these islands would go on to officially be called the Pitcairn Islands, as we heard earlier. Before World War II, the population would swell to over 200 again, but would disperse as the advent of the Postal Service connected the outside world to Pitcairn and encouraged its residents to explore the world like never before. But as the population dwindled and technology focused globalization onto other parts of the world, Pitcairn began harboring a dark secret that would remain in obscurity until the turn of the next century. Next time on Extremities, Crime and Justice on Pitcairn Island. Extremities is written and produced by PJ Scott Blankenship and myself, Sam Denby. The show is edited by Eric Schneider, the amazing artwork is by Simon Buckmaster, and I do have to once again thank both our guests, Brad Brown and Dustin Funheller. Lastly, production help was given by Standard, and this is a Wendover Productions podcast.